right, and welcome to Fast Break Breakfast, MBA Podcast. My name is Keith. I'm here alone for an interview with Blake Murphy today. John and Chuck will be back later this week for a full episode. Gotta say, it was a great weekend. The Grizzlies coming back on the Warriors. Tony Allen played 48 minutes in a basketball game and got 6 steals. It was like my birthday. Couldn't believe that was happening to me. Anyway, today's episode is all about the Toronto Raptors. We will save all my exuberant Grizzlies talk for later in the week, and hopefully they will keep on winning. All right, before we get to the interview, I want to remind you guys, in Nashville, January 18th, a Wednesday, we are having a watch party at Edley's East. Edley's East at 6 p.m. for the Grizzlies-Wizards game, for those of you in Nashville. I also want to tell you guys about Loot Crate. Are you on a quest for epic gear, housewares, and collectibles? Well, Loot Crate brings you between 4 to 6 of the coolest curated mystery items every month straight to your doorstep. The January theme is Origins. See where it all started and explore the iconic origins with historic items featuring Superman, Captain America, Mario, and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So go to lootcrate.com/fastbreak and enter code FASTBREAK to save $3 off any new subscription today. And a reminder, the best way to support our show is to go to patreon.com/fastbreakbreakfast to sign up and become one of our patrons. My guest today is the managing editor of Raptors Republic and a writer who can be found covering the Raptors in several different places, Mr. Blake Murphy. How are you?
Good, man. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, glad to have you on. As is our tradition, I'll ask you, did you have breakfast today, and what'd you have?
Of course I had breakfast. You don't skip breakfast. Not when you need full productive days. You can't skip breakfast. I had a fruit smoothie. I don't really like most fruits and vegetables, so my normal morning is just throw everything into a blender, and then it's dealt with for the day. I don't really have to worry about fruits and vegetables much from there.
Well, so what was in? What fruits did you choose?
Banana, some frozen berries, some kale and spinach, coconut water, protein. I might be missing something. There might be something else in there, too. Avocado, I think.
Wow.
Yeah. Whatever's there, just throw it in.
I would say that started kind of sweet, going, I have a sweet tooth. And I was like, all right. And then it got kind of like, all right, that's just a lot of veggies. So
yeah, it doesn't taste particularly good. And like the protein powder that I have right now is peanut butter. So you throw peanut butter in with all that. It's not a very good mix, but I just kind of chug it and then it's out of the way.
I feel like that's like a Arnold Schwarzenegger at the beginning of maybe 3 of his movies where he's doing that. Like he's waking up, just pouring all the things, all the eggs. I want to say Commando and Sixth Day both start that way. But yeah.
And I know Stallone's done it too. The raw egg in a cup and just throw it back. I haven't gone that far.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have you in today to talk about the Raptors, and it is Monday morning after a difficult loss to the Rockets, kind of wrapping up a little bit of a bumpy couple week stretch for the Raptors, where maybe they started that as thinking they're more elite near the very top of the league and have finished it. In my opinion, I'm curious if you differ, maybe falling back to the pack of just being, they're really good, but maybe they're not in the conversation of like a top 3 or 4 team. So how are you feeling after this little bumpy stretch?
I'm feeling tired, most of all. The schedule that they've played on, I can only imagine how they feel. So you're right. It's been a bumpy stretch. They've dropped 5 of 7, a couple bad losses in there. Like they lost to Phoenix on the second night of a back-to-back. That's a team they should beat. They probably should have not blown double-digit leads to Chicago and Houston back-to-back. But there are some qualifiers here, too, and I don't want to make excuses for them because every NBA team goes through this over 82 games. But since December 21st, yesterday was only the second day that the Raptors had been in Toronto without a flight for a full day. So they had this 6-game West Coast trip. They returned for 1 game, hit Chicago, came back for a back-to-back against Houston. So as far as fatiguing stretches of schedule go, they're probably just about running on empty at this point. Doesn't give the defense a free pass. That's fallen all the way back to 21st after kind of reaching league average there for a little bit. The offense is still functioning, but not in the same way where It looked completely unstoppable there for a little bit. And they continue to, until Jarrett Sullinger returns, look for answers at the power forward position. Patrick Patterson came back against Houston on Sunday, but he came off the bench because that's going to be his role forever, it seems. And then he was on a minutes restriction. So the Raptors started small, and they had started Lucas Nogueira at the four before, and they had started Terrence Ross for a second half, and Pascal Siakam's now fallen out of the rotation. So the uncertainty at that position and the defense sliding back, the defensive rebounding has been a big part of that. They've fallen to 30th in the NBA. There are, as much as fatigue's a factor, there are definitely some concerns here. This should be a telling week. They get Boston on Tuesday. Boston could draw even for second in the East, which is, you know, some Raptors fans are pretty concerned about that. And then the schedule turns easier, so they'll have that opportunity to kind of right themselves a little bit. And if the struggles continue into Boston and then an easier stretch of schedule, well, then those concerns get magnified a lot more, I think.
Yeah, do you think the actual Raptors, do you think their quality is closer to what they were early in the season, or are we just seeing the natural ebbs and flows kind of the NBA season? Like, they're playing really well, and obviously this tough travel schedule and playing tough competition, you know, has brought them, made them look maybe a little worse than we are. So is it in between there, or do you think it's closer to the earlier in the season?
Yeah, I think it's somewhere in between. They're on a 53-win pace right now. I think I had them at 52 before the season. I thought the defense would slide a little bit. I thought it might take the young guys some time to hit the ground running. And they were on a 60-win pace there for a little bit. But I tried to caution at that point that, like, they weren't going to be the best offense of all time over 82 games, probably. And, you know, they're just, this team has a defensive ceiling, which is higher than 21st. It's probably somewhere around like maybe 12 or 13. They could be maybe a shade above average. But this team wasn't as good as the 60-win pace. I don't think they're this bad either. Like, I don't think they're the type of team that in normal times is going to drop back-to-back games, like losing double-digit leads on back-to-back nights. They hadn't even lost a fourth-quarter lead. Sorry, they hadn't lost the game in which they led entering the fourth until Saturday. And now they've done it twice in a row. They won't lose that Phoenix game many times if you played it out. So I think they're better than this, but they, you know, I had them for about 52 wins. They're on a 53-win pace. Maybe they've shown enough to repeat at the 56-win level, but they kind of, the story all season has been they're a little bit boring in that they are what they've been for the last little bit, and they are what everyone kind of thought they are.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the other repeating playoff teams have those same situations where it's like the Clippers and the Warriors are in this regular season where they can't really prove any of the questions about their team until we get to April, you know, until we get to May. And I don't know, I feel like the Raptors might sort of fall into that category because, again, they've had a little playoff success, although it was still, nerve-wracking last year with their actually advancing to the finals, but it wasn't the conference finals, but it wasn't very easy. You talked about them having difficulty at the power forward position, waiting for Jarrett Sullinger to get back. I don't know how you feel about Sullinger. I'm almost certain he's not the answer to the Raptors' almost like 3-year quest for a power forward. What do you think the Raptors should do with that power forward position? Because they have been, as you mentioned, rotating the lineup, switching the lineup. Pascal Siakam was starting for a while, and then most recently Norm Powell started, and they slid down to Murray Carroll, and Bebe Nogueira got a start. So what's going on with the Raptors' power forward position, and what do you think they should be doing there?
Well, it's a little tired at this point, but I've thought for all of this year and last year that Patrick Patterson was the logical starter there. He's a low usage guy who spaces the floor, which fits with the offense when you have Lowry and DeRozan out there and a non-stretchy center. And then defensively, he's a really high IQ team defender. He's a good communicator out there. And when you have Jonas Valanciunas out there, who is, you know, not an elite defender, not as bad as some people make him out to be sometimes, but hardly, you know, I don't even think he's average if you stripped all context out of it. Adding another high IQ defender who's good in the team concept, who can switch a couple positions, who can help Damari Carroll with some of those bigger threes. This has long made sense to me. The lineup data, when he does play with the starters, has backed this up emphatically. For whatever reason, the Raptors prefer him to come off the bench. So it seems to me that, you know, before Patterson suffered this recent injury, there were 5 games in a row where he started the second half of games for Pascal Siakam. Mm-hmm. Patterson then went down. Terrence Ross started a half. Then Lucas Nogueira started, as we kind of just went over. The writing on the wall to me says that they are just holding this position and trying to figure things out in the short term until Jared Sullinger's back. I agree with you. Sullinger is definitely not the long-term answer. He's on a 1-year deal. They wouldn't even have his bird rights after the season. But he's a 24-year-old guy who is an elite rebounder, especially on the defensive end. That's Toronto's probably their biggest weakness right now. So even if there are questions about how him and Jonas Valanciunas will defend together, at least when the team does get stops, he should help clean up those misses, which has been a huge issue. I'm not sure that he's any less comfortable a fit than Pascal Siakam, who is probably a better defender already at this stage, but who is, you know, a little overeager and a little overhelping. So I don't know. Sullinger's not the answer, but Sullinger is going to be the who they use as the answer once he's back, I think. Longer term, I have no idea. Like, they might re-up Patrick Patterson at what seems like it's probably going to be a $13 to $15 million deal. And if they pay him that, I think they have to finally pull the trigger and start him. I know the team thinks Siakam can kind of grow into that role longer term as he improves his ball skill and his shooting. But that might be, you know, 2-3 years down the line. So it's going to be a question mark until it's not. And I think that's why people have been so excited to hear Paul Millsap's name in the rumor mill attached to the Raptors, because it has been an open spot for so, so long. And that would finally be a guy that, you know, there are no question marks about it. But that's, you know, that's its own thing and its own level of realism. And for now, it looks like Sullinger's the short term answer. And then we'll have these conversations for like a 8th year in a row next year.
Right. And I mean, I think it is what it's at least 3 years in a row where the team hasn't been sure kind of about that power forward spot. And it feels like they've been playing it by ear as they go through the season and the playoffs. Like last year, like they were starting Luis Scola. And I felt like there was almost a tacit understanding that we're going to do this until things get tough and then we're going to switch. And so do you think the fact that now we're carrying that into another year of kind of doing a rotating the lineups of starting lineups, first and second halves, do you think that's an issue with roster construction, or is that maybe like a bad habit of Dwayne Casey's?
I don't think it's an issue with roster construction. Like, ideally you would have a guy who's unquestionably a starting caliber power forward. But at the same time, I think Patrick Patterson is actually that, and he fits well. The issue is that Patterson has been so good off the bench for them. He's such a big part of important bench units, and he kind of stabilizes that second unit with his defense and his shooting, that Dwayne Casey, I think he's more loath to take Patterson away from the second unit than he is to start Patterson. I think the fact that he eventually gave in and started Patterson in the playoffs last year says a lot about the logic of starting Patterson. You know, I think Casey kind of he always talks about the chain reaction if you make a change like that. And that's fair. But the reason I was more in favor of it early in the year is because if you do it now, then you don't have to worry about it later in the year and what's going to happen. You can kind of figure out those secondary rotations since. So I don't want to say it's too big a fault of Casey, because Casey has done such a good job this year of being more flexible, trying new things, shaking up lineups. And that's something he's been much slower to do in the past. Him, even Sunday night, starting Norman Powell and sliding Damari Carroll to the four, or starting two centers at the same time. These are looks that Dwayne Casey wouldn't have gone too much in the past unless absolutely forced to. So he deserves credit for trying new things and being flexible. I guess the feeling is that the reason that they won't start Patterson at this point is because they for whatever reason, really like Sullinger in that spot when he's back. I don't have a good answer for you, though. It's kind of one of those things that we've been talking about for 2 years in Toronto. And like the argument's been so beaten to death that I've almost lost sight of like why this hasn't actually happened. I kind of just have it in my head that it is what it is now. I don't know. Patterson should be starting, but they're going to start Sullinger. And then, yeah, like last year, it might be fine. And if it's not, they'll make do until it's absolutely untenable. And at that point, it might make them really uncomfortable.
Yeah. So one of our co-hosts, my co-host, John, he speaks ill of Dwayne Casey a lot, even though he did apologize in one of our segments recently to Dwayne Casey. I think basing it on, he's always had difficulty with the rotations, like we've been talking about, and the fact that he waits till it's untenable to make a change. So I'm curious, do you think that Dwayne Casey has been a really good coach for this Raptors team? Because I'll cite where this team keeps being better than I think they're going to be every year by a few games. But then there's obviously the postseason struggles where if it wasn't for, you know, them winning that 7-game series against the Pacers in the first round last year, which a lot of it could be credited to Frank Vogel making some weird decisions by playing Ty Lawson a ton. And then, you know, 10 years ago, that Solomon Hill game-tying three-pointer would have counted because they wouldn't have reviewed it. So it seems just based on the fact that the Raptors advanced to the conference finals last year, which is no small feat, but they did it in 7-game series against the Pacers and against a injured Miami team, that kind of, again, reset the clock on Dwayne Casey and the Raptors. So that excessively long question from me is, how do you feel about the job Dwayne Casey's done? How much confidence do you have in him?
I think something that comes up with Dwayne Casey, and I think there are probably 28 fan bases out there who are like this with their head coach, no matter the quality, is that sometimes the macro can get lost for the micro. And what I mean by that is Dwayne Casey has taken this roster. He's taken a franchise that lacks stability forever. He's given them a culture and an identity. And as much as that stuff is like kind of wishy-washy and soft, and I know I'm an analytic person by nature, and a lot of this stuff takes me some time to kind of accept that it actually exists. But that continuity and that culture and that role certainty is important. And he's taken a guy like Kyle Lowry, who didn't fit elsewhere and couldn't find a groove, and helped him. DeMar DeRozan has improved leaps and bounds every year with Dwayne Casey. They've managed to be in win now mode while also developing talent. Sunday night, if you can ignore Sunday night, Terrence Ross is having the best season of his career. They've managed to keep Norman Powell ready whenever called upon. There are some young guys on this team doing well. And then that kind of stability and continuity lets you do some things in the offseason, like trust your guys that they'll continue to get better. The Raptors have outstripped expectations. I think this will be the fourth year in a row now, probably, including my own expectations. And part of that is likely Casey and the chemistry that's built there and the culture and that continuity that helps them start seasons running and things like that. There's also the matter of keeping the same coach and the same core together has afforded the Raptors some opportunities. And Casey gets the one thing that bugs me about when Casey gets crapped on a little bit is the uninventiveness of the offense, which to be fair to everyone or this straw man that I'm building here, late in games and end of quarters, the Raptors do tend to resort to some pet sets that are designed to get DeRozan or Lowry attacking one-on-one. But one thing they've done really well this year is they've taken their pet sets that they've used for years. They know how teams are going to defend it, and they add a lot of counters to this. And that's something you can't do without the same coaching staff. It's something you can't do without the same players. And I think there's value in that, in learning enough about yourself that you know how teams are going to attack you, and you can counter that before they can even do it. At the same time, yes, I understand that some of the micro stuff, some of the late game play calling, some of the rotations are a little slow to move. I think Casey started to break out of that in the postseason last year, and he's been a lot more flexible this year. The team's entire offensive identity goes against what Casey originally wanted here because the game has changed and the personnel has changed. So I think Casey's done well being flexible. I don't think he's the best coach in the NBA, but I think he does a very good job managing this team over 365 days. And then there are small 10-second spurts or 30-second spurts where Dwayne Casey does a bad job. And unfortunately, those are higher leverage spots, and those are things that are easier to grasp onto because they stand out more and there's the primacy effect at play. So I think Casey's better than, as with all things, he's better than his worst moments, and he doesn't deserve 100% of the credit for the Raptors' success. But I'm not sure they'd be in a better place had they let Casey go this offseason and they brought in, say, a Frank Vogel or whoever else was available.
Yep. You mentioned he's done a good job optimizing this team and getting them like a culture of winning and getting them to being in the playoff conversation and even the title conversation every year for the last few years. And that's kind of rare because it seems like this team, and I'm a Grizzlies fan, and I've made this argument before about the grit grind era, that it was accidental. Like, they didn't know Marc Gasol was good, and the signing of Zebo had huge question marks, but then it turned out to be really good. Team building wise, this current era of Raptors seems accidental or unintentional. I think I saw something on Raptors Republic yesterday. I was like looking back at old articles talking about how the Raptors were going to be tanking for Wiggins. And then obviously they made the playoffs that year. So what can you tell me about the way this era has gone of Raptors basketball, where maybe it wasn't totally on purpose that they'd be competing every year?
Yeah, well, I think everyone remembers that the plan was to tear down a little bit. Andrea Bargnani was sent out. Rudy Gay was sent out. The Raptors had a trade in place to send Kyle Lowry to the Knicks. And then James Dolan balked at sending the Raptors another pick and dealing with Masai Ujiri again. And that, even with that deal done, I think the plan was still to tear down, but it bought the Raptors some time. And what they did with that time was find a quick chemistry and kind of go on a run to where Masai Ujiri thought, okay, well, we'll let this play out and see what happens. And then they kind of built from there. I think they got to realize that DeRozan and Lowry played really well together, that Lowry had some upside that he maybe hadn't shown to that point, that DeRozan was still getting better. So they kind of rolled it over. And I think at that, even at that point, it was only a 1 year rollover. It was see what we have with these guys. Let's sign Kyle Lowry to a below market deal and bet that he's going to improve. DeMar DeRozan's still under a below market deal. So there was really no, you know, obviously there's the opportunity cost and the time loss of rolling that core over for one more year and seeing you can't, you know, that's another year you can't tank or anything like that. It's another high pick you maybe don't get. But in terms of, you know, they weren't locking these guys up to the type of deals they're now going to be locked up to. We could talk about that later with, you know, $26 million for DeRozan and maybe 30 for Lowry. And if they were to get Millsap another 30, it was kind of a low cost investment to roll it over for one more year and see what's there. And then the team got better and they continued to get better together. And they had these assets around that core to continue building with, you know, the Raptors entered the year as the third youngest team in the NBA this year. So it was an accident. The plan was Lowry would be out. I don't know what would have happened with DeRozan, but that would have been an interesting discussion because he was much younger than, you know, the type of guy you'd normally send out. I think at that point he was only 23 or 24 and on a really reasonable deal. So maybe they would have sent him out on that below market deal, but maybe they would have kept him and he would now be leading an even younger core. So it's interesting. It's what's made kind of the Raptors difficult to evaluate over these last couple of years is that on paper, it didn't really make sense and it made sense for them to go another way. And they kind of just found this like weird ethereal chemistry that you can't really explain all that well. And it takes, you know, 3,000 word articles to explain why their offense is good. So it's a weird spot. It's why, you know, this is 4 years into the Raptors being pretty good now. And people still don't really buy in. They're 24-13, and you know there are holes in their game. But the comments we're getting at Raptors Republic right now after this stretch are, oh, they're the Lou Williams, Gravis Vasquez year Raptors. They're going to lose in the first round. So even within Toronto, there's still not a faith that this core, which has been good now for 4 years, but has struggled some in the playoffs, is good. And I think part of that is how it started. This wasn't by design. It wasn't a plan. So when things start to go bad, it's really easy to revert to, oh yeah, this didn't make a lot of sense in the first place anyway. So maybe it doesn't make sense now. And when it's something kind of fleeting and ethereal like chemistry and continuity and culture, those things kind of exist until they don't. So I think that's why maybe more than other teams that have been 50 win teams or high 40s teams for this long, the Raptors fan base is a little more fragile, I guess is the word. I think that speaks to the way it started, where half the fan base wanted a teardown and no one really expected this anyway.
Yeah. So now that they find themselves in this position of they have been competing for so many years and they've done it, as you said, with, you know, slightly under market contracts, like they paid Lowry, but now it's peanuts in comparison to the rest of the contracts. And then even last year, you know, you could find plenty of articles written that DeMar DeRozan shouldn't get a max contract, but he's lived up to it so far. But that being said, so now going into the future, and you've mentioned a couple times, Paul Millsap seems to be available, and everyone is pointing to the Raptors as a team that maybe should go, you know, quote unquote, all in and get him. So I'm curious, like, do you think the Raptors should get him? I'll say I do. Like, I definitely do. I think you're at the point where, hey, you're at the top of your conference. Like, just go for it. And I know there's the concerns about him and Lowry both needing huge contracts next year. But so what do you think about the Raptors if they were to get Paul Millsap and if they should do it?
Yeah, I'm in favor of Paul Millsap deal up to a reasonable price, of course. I don't think Millsap closes the gap with Cleveland this year, especially now that they've got Korver and have that trade exception still to get another point guard maybe. I don't think he closes the gap, but it narrows it a little bit and makes the Eastern Conference Finals. It makes it more certain that the Raptors would get to an Eastern Conference Finals rematch, and then it would make that rematch a little more interesting at least. But even then, looking forward, you know, guys like Paul Millsap are hard to come by. Even at age 30, he'll be 32 by the time the trade deadline rolls around. If they were to not acquire Millsap, they're not going to have cap space in the summer anyway. They would be re-signing Lowry and Patterson. Even if they let Patterson walk, it would be tough to maneuver into enough cap space to make a meaningful move. So you'd kind of be hoping that one of the young guys on the team emerges into that role, or you find another Jared Sullinger below market deal on like a 1 year flyer like they did with Biombo before that. So yeah, Millsap, guys like Millsap don't hit the market. And to add another, to add a third top 25 player to this team, that's kind of how you want and have to build teams right now, especially to compete with LeBron. And LeBron's not going to slow down next year, but if he takes even a quarter of a step back, maybe that window's there while Millsap and Lowry are still in their primes and DeRozan's at the peak of his. So I'm in favor of it. You know, you'd hope to get Millsap and Lowry below their full max so that you're not spending way, way into the tax. And even if they got them below their max, they might have to send out a salary or two to make the luxury tax bill more palatable. But I don't see another way that this Raptors team can take the meaningful step forward. I think their young players will continue to get better, and that's great. But I don't think that is going to be enough to, if the Raptors' ultimate goal is to challenge a LeBron-led Cleveland team and not challenge a post-LeBron Cleveland team, then I think Millsap's their best bet at kind of closing that gap sometime in the next, you know, say 1.5 seasons.
What for you would be a price that's too much to pay for Paul Millsap?
It's tough. I was talking with Brad Rowland of Locked On Hawks on a podcast recently, and the deal we kind of came to was Terrence Ross, Jakob Poeltl, and a pick. I think Jared Sullinger had to be in there for salary matching. I don't have the trade machine in front of me, but obviously Sullinger would be superfluous if you were bringing in Millsap anyway. So asset-wise, you know, Ross, Poeltl, and a pick. It would be tough to lose Ross's shooting, and he's got two more years beyond this at a slightly below market deal. Poeltl was the number 9 pick, and the team was higher on him than that. And I know some teams were pretty high on him because he's essentially bust proof. I haven't talked to anyone who doesn't think he'll at least be a quality backup. And then the first round pick, I mean, from a Toronto perspective, you could trade all the first round picks while they're good. I'm not, when a team's already this young and has this many young players, you know, the 25 or 27th pick is not moving the needle a ton for me. So I don't know if that's enough. I know Mark Stein had the report that Atlanta would like a high pick. The Raptors don't have that to offer. I don't know if Poeltl, a couple months removed from being drafted, would count as a high pick still. But something like Ross, Poeltl, whatever makes the salary work, and a pick is what Brad and I had kind of come to as a reasonable deal on either side. I think if you have to give up another major asset beyond that, like if you're talking Ross and Corey Joseph, or if you're talking, you know, Ross and Norman Powell wouldn't make sense from a roster balance perspective because there's an extra wing in there and they'd be so thin on the wing. But once you start throwing a fourth asset on top of Ross, one of the prospects and one of the picks, then it maybe gets a little dicey, especially without a guarantee that Millsap's gonna re-up. But given the price for Korver and the teams that are involved in a potential Millsap deal, there aren't teams other than Denver that could really offer that big pick and would have the right assets with reasonable salaries that Atlanta would want to build with. So I don't know. I think there's a deal to be had there around a Ross Poeltl pick package, but I don't think I'd go too much higher than that, because at that point I think you'd probably be bidding against yourself. I think there's a deal there somewhere.
Yeah, that deal seems pretty good to me. I think if I was the Hawks, I might have interest also definitely in Corey Joseph, because I'm not a huge Schroeder fan, and I feel like the fewer minutes and maybe a stronger backup for the Hawks might be good. But yeah, those will be tough questions for the Raptors to figure out. And I also think we talked about the big contracts that maybe Lowry and Millsap wouldn't both demand a supermax contract. I do wonder, as now that the salary cap has risen so much and we've gotten used to it a little, if maybe NBA teams will stop giving kind of every good player a max contract. Like the last 3 years, it's pretty much if you're good, like a decent player, you get a max, like the Chandler Parsons, Nick Batum type thing. I do wonder if going forward, teams will have a little more discretion with how much they drop down those $30 million contracts.
Yeah, and I think there's something to be found out when it comes to the ego of such deals, where, you know, Paul Millsap is a guy who everyone raves about from a character and locker room perspective. Is he the type of guy who on his last big contract needs to be paid the supermax so he feels he was paid the supermax? Or are guys like him and even Lowry going to look at the market and look at what the max would have been 2 years ago and say, okay, look, that's a reasonable amount of money. If I can make $25 million a year and be on a really competitive team, I don't know. It's tough because that's a lot of money in real terms. It's easy to say, yeah, oh yeah, guys should take a discount because they're making $35 million now. They would have only made $25 million 2 years ago, but that's $10 million. You know, you're talking $40, $50 million over the life of a deal, which is, you know, generational lives changing money. So I don't know. It's going to be really interesting to see how much flexibility the cap going up makes the maxes more valuable. To me, it makes it provides more wiggle room to get guys to sub max deals and still pay them really well. DeRozan signed for what worked out to about 91% of the max. Maybe you hope to get guys in that kind of range. I'm not sure. It's interesting. Obviously, you can't afford a scenario. You know, if they signed Millsap and Lowry both to the Supermax, which is estimated about $36 million in year one right now, then you've got $100 million tied up in three guys, and there's no way you're ever not going to have a huge luxury tax bill. So it's tough. There are a lot of tough team building questions with the new CBA and with the Raptors. You know, if the Raptors core were a couple years younger, it would be a different question where maybe you say, no, we're not going to invest that because we can be patient. We can let the younger guys develop. But Lowry is a diminutive 31-year-old point guard. And Paul Millsap will be 32 by the time the free agency rolls around. And DeMar DeRozan is 26. And, you know, he gets better every year. But until he adds a three-point shot and we see, you know, how his game starts to age as he rounds toward the back end of his peak years, you know, the window might not be open perpetually for this team. So it's a tough spot to be in. And, you know, you jump on Millsap because guys like Millsap don't become available all that often. But it probably... you know, you're probably looking at a 2-3 year window before those contracts look a little more sour and your team building is a little more difficult.
Right. All right. Last question. Why does Masai Ujiri get a pass on Bruno Caboclo? Is it because Caboclo is so adorable?
Yeah. I mean, the mustache is coming in nicely. He's growing out his hair a little bit. So he's got like the like early Vince fro going right now. No, I think, part of it is that I think the logic still holds up. Obviously, look, it would have been a lot better if the Raptors had a D-League team in place year one, because he could have done the kind of Josh Huestis thing where he did a D-League season off the NBA books, where he wasn't eating a year of his rookie salary, something like that. That wasn't the case. But I think the logic still holds up enough where the guy has an 8-foot wingspan. He's 7 feet tall now. He's shooting threes in the D-League on a large sample at like roughly a league average clip. So you look at the measurements and the fact that he can hit threes, and he was so young and so raw. And I think there are a lot of teams that at some point in that draft would have taken a flyer on him, or at some point in this draft, if you were in this draft, would have taken a flyer on him. And you see how an experiment like that can work out with a guy like Giannis. Obviously, Giannis was a lot further along and had proven a lot more than the Caboclo. But the logic from a like create a player standpoint kind of holds the same. The Caboclo thing was always going to be a 4-year experiment, so it's not done yet. He's not had the best of years in the D-League, but he's improving defensively at least. So they're going to give it the whole 4 years. They're going to play out this year. They picked up his option for next year. Look, the odds are probably in favor of this being a bad mark on Ujiri's resume originally. And I know that guys like Clint Capella and Rodney Hood, who have become very good contributors on very good teams, went after Caboclo. But you know, busting on the number 20 pick when you swung for the fences long term is not going to look like that terrible a move, I don't think. And there's still a lower percentage chance that Caboclo becomes like a deep role player as like kind of a 3-and-D guy at the forward spots. I'm not sure how realistic that is, but you look at the measurements and the threes and the slight defensive improvement, and maybe it still happens.
Sounds good. I'm just saying that Masai is bulletproof, as far as I can tell. Nothing he does slows him down.
Anyway. Yeah, and he's got some – look, he took some gambles in the draft at some point, especially in the second round when he was with Denver, that turned into nothing. But he's gotten – you know, that's what you have to do. And when you're using these picks, especially late in the first round, where it's unlikely that a guy is going to be much more than a deep role player anyway when you're picking 20th or 27th, you kind of got to swing for upside a little bit. I think they did that with Pascal Siakam this year. You know, I think people wanted them to do that more with the number 9 pick. They kind of – Poeltl was – you know, an unsexy pick because he's, you know, at worst going to be a quality backup and at best probably going to be a decent starter. So, yeah, I don't know. These are the kind of, especially when you're a 56 win team and you're going to use your picks. I don't know. I'm in favor of swinging for the fences. The Caboclo thing, if and when it doesn't work out, is going to be a joke for a really long time. But when you look at Ujiri's entire thing, like you said, he's going to be, you know, he's done a lot more good than bad.
Yeah, most definitely. All right. Well, thanks, Blake, for your time. Tell people again where they can read you and hear you online.
They can read me at Raptors Republic. I'm the managing editor there. I also contribute to The Athletic Toronto, Vice, a couple other places. And they can find me on Twitter at BlakeMurphyODC.
All right. Thanks, Blake. Thanks for your time. Appreciate having you on. Have a good one.
Keith, thanks so much, man.
All right. That was great stuff from Blake Murphy about the Toronto Raptors. Make sure you check him out on Twitter and go to Raptors Republic for all the Raptors news you need. Thanks, you guys, for listening. Make sure you subscribe. Go ahead and write us some iTunes reviews. We appreciate those of you who have taken time to do that. Go to patreon.com/fastbreakbreakfast. Follow us on Twitter. Like us on Facebook. All right, you guys are the best. Thanks for listening. And remember, breakfast is the most important thing.